the growers are just a lot more sophisticated.
Yeah.
About how to win.
Yeah.
And the, you know, the consulting firms are just have shown them that they do not have to obey the law. I mean, as you know, as Neanderthal as they are in their labor mentality, right? They weren't as clever as they could be in breaking the law mm-hmm. in the early days
yeah.
to win an election. Now they know from the experts that they don't have to obey the law.
Mm-hmm. And in fact,
don't tell people you're going to fire them. Fire some of them.
As Caesar said, it's actually it's they're rewarded for breaking the law. That I had heard him say that before, but I didn't understand it till this morning when he spelled it out more.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that too much myself.
You say
the fact
if,
that they you know, can't if, have an election.
If they break the law and we do nothing, then there's no problem for them. If they break the law and we appeal it, they know that they will not have to face another election there for up to 5 years.
Because it's being adjudicated in the court somewhere. So, I mean, it certainly raises the question whether you can organize workers under an American labor law.
Yeah.
Even a good one. I don't, for the life of me, know. Well, I know why, but it's very bad that the labor movement in general has accepted what they've accepted under the National Labor Relations Act for all these years. And now, you know, under Reagan, it's just becoming, I mean, it's just horrible what they're doing. I mean, the decisions that have come down under the National Labor Relations Act, you know, make the ALRA look like some left-wing conspiracy, as bad as it is. I mean, he's got union busters making law back there in the National Labor Relations Board. And, you know, workers are getting no protection. On decisions, here it's often a matter of just delay and delay and delay and delay and delay, and so nothing ever really happens.
It makes me wonder if there's really any, I mean, he wasn't willing to accede to this as far as, but I really wonder if,
was
if
a mistake.
It's good to have any kind of a law.
Was it a mistake?
Yeah. And he's saying if he had to do it again, he would still have
he would
the
do
law,
it.
But I find it hard to understand.
There's one thing it does do. It keeps the Teamsters at bay. They can't just come in, right? They have to win. Teamsters or anybody else. Mm-hmm. But the Teamsters thought Teamsters were calling dental plans and medical plans as to how they could protect the workers at Hanson, that they thought they were going to win.
Mm-hmm.
And out of about 980-some votes, they got 33. I knew we wouldn't win the runoff. We never win runoffs. Mm. I mean, if you give the company another week
mm-hmm.
to do, you know, to do a slick, sophisticated campaign of firing people and threatening to go out of business and all the things that these labor consultants do, mm-hmm. your chances are horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so close the first time anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second time, I think it was amazing they did as well as they did. Artie Mendoza has often talked about those Hanson workers, kind of chuckling at how smart they've been.
Uh-huh.
They go on our marches. They go to our rallies. Every year at contract renegotiating time, they weigh their buttons in the fields, tell the employer what the union's getting for their, and then Hanson buckles under and gives them what the union's getting. And then they take their buttons off and they don't pay dues and
have none of the worries and responsibilities of union
right,
membership.
That's right. They just slick. Irresponsible, but slick.
That's pretty well organized at Hanson Ranch, apparently. But is that true at other places, too?
I don't think that's true. It happens, though.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not bad, right? I mean, people are getting improvements.
Mm-hmm.
Secondary, you know, ripple effect of the union itself.
Mm-hmm. Except for the long run.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the questions I didn't get to ask Caesar, I'm just realizing now I didn't get to ask him, is whether he thinks the union will ever get out of California.
Mm-hmm. That would have been a good question. I don't know. it doesn't worry me as much as it used to be. Used to. Because anywhere from 25 to 33% of all, you know, farm workers are here.
Mm-hmm.
Because the fruits and vegetables are here, right? Obviously not exclusively, but a significant proportion. So, to do it well here is a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we've just raised expectations, mostly of supporters, really.
Mm-hmm.
Way, way, way too early. It's just harder than anybody ever thought. The planning we did a year and a half ago at Shaver Lake, we spent, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks. But basically concluded that the union's concentration had been the ALRB, and now the union's concentration had to be the boycott.
Another thing I wanted to know.
It was a painful process.
I knew I could ask you, so I didn't ask Caesar. There is not a restriction on the boycott as long as people are saying, but you can buy union grapes. That's
right. On the primary boycott, you can do almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
Once you start going after the stores or a secondary product,
mm-hmm.
I think the ALRB says you have to have won an election, like at Bruce Church.
Mm-hmm.
So the laws, there are limits.
So with this boycott, it'll have to stick to being a primary boycott? If it's going to be held as a fairly generic mm-hmm. boycott?
Mm-hmm. Or a very, I don't know, subtle secondary boycott.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Right now it is exclusively a primary boycott mm-hmm. because we're using the secondary energy on Red Coach.
Mm-hmm.
How we would orchestrate a... To me... Asking people in front of stores not to shop at Safeway is not a secondary boycott mm-hmm. under the law, but that's never been decided by any court anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's still our free speech right to ask people
mm-hmm.
to help farm workers. Classic secondary boycott is asking the clerks not to work
mm-hmm.
or the butchers not to cross our picket line.
Mm-hmm.
But asking customers, you know, not to shop there, it's not clear. I mean, the growers know it's clear, and we've always called it a secondary boycott, but legally I'm not sure it is.
Mm-hmm.
Someday we'll find out. And in the mail, doing it in the mail.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's going to be interesting. But the goal this time is to negotiate with the whole industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he told me that.
Not
with a, what's it called, pre-contract or... agreement of some kind?
With whoever the industry designates to negotiate for the whole industry. For elections and a contract if we win.
Yeah. Makes so much sense.
We had the power, I was thinking, well, we were talking about it the last few weeks ago, we were at Shaver Lake again to mm-hmm. talk about the boycott. We had the power in 70 to do that. And we didn't. But if we had, I mean, it would have been a disaster anyway. I mean, you know, it was a disaster. What we won was a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
If we had won the whole state, I mean, it would have been a total disaster.
I
mean, there would have been riots.
The organizational follow-up.
Signing people up, the hiring halls.
Yeah.
See, our rules then were that you had to be dispatched from a union hire hall to mm-hmm. go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to be paid up dues. Your dues had to be paid up
mm-hmm. before you were dispatched.
And that caused us, mm-hmm. you know, well, Teamsters made a lot of hay with that, right? Even after we changed it.
Yeah.
Because people would come from Mexico to, remember, to Coachella, mm-hmm. and they'd owe 3 or 4 months dues, and mm-hmm. they couldn't be dispatched until they dug in their pockets or borrowed money to come up with the dues that they owed. Oh, God. It was terrible. They still talk about things like that 10 years later. But so 70 just would have, I mean, we could all be dead. Killed by farm workers.
In the Jacques Levy book, it's a wonderful little section where, it wasn't it Richard Chavez that was left behind?
In Delano.
Oh, I thought, I just felt for him. I thought, oh my God, this poor guy.
I can imagine. We sent a bunch of boycotters up to Delano to help him. You know, group would
come
that
summer. That was worse than before.
Can you imagine? On those poor kids. These idealistic, you know, expectations that the revolution has come and all farm workers, and here the farm workers are at the window screaming and yelling at Richard. They're supposed to love us.
That was a great story. Well, I do want to, I would rather just be able to talk about this current situation, but for the first chapter, was there something else you wanted to...
Well, I was just looking at my notes. I took some notes while we were in there.
Yeah.
I didn't know whether you'd gotten clear the strike fund and the nonviolent action fund are the same thing. It doesn't really matter too much, but I just thought...
Yeah, I thought that they were the same thing, but I wasn't real sure.
Yeah, he mentioned them both in the same sentence, and I thought I'd better... The strike fund, it's what it used to be called. It's now called the nonviolent action fund because we use the resources for both strike and boycott. And the convention, you know, authorized that about 3 years ago. And then all the time he was talking about the mentality of the growers mm-hmm. and the law. Well, I mean, remember how horrified they were at the ALRA, right? Somehow this law was going to be applied to them, really applied to them. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking of the water, you know, the 160-acre limitation all the time. You know, that's been in effect since 1902. And they have never, never, never had to pay any attention to it.
Right.
But just one way or another, they've always, you know, wiggled themselves out of it by administrative, you know, by bribery and administrative action. The law's always been there. It's always been very clear. It has never applied to California growers.
Mm-hmm. But when was that
only
passed?
Because of their power.
What was that?
The Reclamation Act, 1905, something like that. Way back there.
I once knew that.
Even before we were born, Pat.
It's astonishing that anything that old is still around. But we can understand why it's so impotent. That's a very good parallel, though. Anything else that needed clarifying?
No, okay. I don't remember what he said about Salyer. I was just thinking that what he said about Salyer only made sense because it was a highly polarized strike situation, mm-hmm. as opposed to being, you know, a normal routine organizing situation. In other words, the workers, Salyer had done something to the workers, and they had gone out on strike, mm-hmm. and there was these two camps, you know, facing off against each other. Mm-hmm. And as I say, I don't remember what Caesar was talking about, but I was thinking to myself, what he's saying only makes complete sense because it was that mm-hmm. kind of a situation. So, as I said, I don't remember what it applies to.
When I listen to the tape again, I'll take that into consideration.
Yeah.
Oh, and I do want to ask you, the dues really are covering the expenses of the union at this point, in terms of the basic expenses apart from that
fund? He didn't really answer that. He said we're
he said close to 100% is what he said.
That's true. Like around 78, 79, 80, 81. Ever come home?
Percent of the routine expenses.
As I say, it had been mm-hmm. for like 77, 78, 79, 80, and we are still in the black.
Yeah.
But I think if we analyzed the end of last year and the beginning of this year, that we would see that a higher percentage of our income is from contributions. Mm-hmm. It's probably close to 90% that's dues supported. But we're spending more money. That's the reason. We're spending more money, and so we need that extra money mm-hmm. from supporters, and that's coming because of the direct mail.
Mm-hmm. What is the budget about, approximately?
We don't want to publicize this,
okay?
But it's about $250,000 a month, a couple million a year,
mm-hmm.
2 to 3 million a year.
Mm.
And we get most of that news. Although, you know, they of course fluctuate somewhat during the year.
Mm-hmm.
But we are getting a lot more in individual contributions because of the direct mail
mm-hmm.
campaign. I brought the suitcase in.
Oh, okay, I'm going to take my double bag.
Oh, really?
Absolutely.
The big blue one and the...
Oh, I don't know what I'm taking. I don't even know what you're taking. You don't even know what you're taking.
I know, but I will.
I know. You don't want much to choose from, so it's not much of a deal.
And you need to leave about 1:30?
No, that too.
Okay. I'm getting ready to start writing the first chapter. And that chapter is focused on the early relationship between the California Migrant Ministry and both CSER's work and also the you know the community development kind of training and all that stuff. And in preparation for that, I wanted to get some of your recollections about your early relationship with CSER, which I really have never known about before. I only knew about the part after he got to Delano, but you knew him when he was still in Oxnard?
No. When I met CSER, he was working in L.A.
Oh.
And I met him shortly after I came to Los Angeles in mm-hmm. September of 61. I met Fred and CSER and Tony Rios together at some cafe over in East L.A. And it was just sort of like a get acquainted. I don't even remember what we talked about. I just remember feeling very young and green, but knowing that Doug said, you know, you need to get to know these people. And then maybe there we did talk about like where I would get some CSO training. And so my first exposure to CSO was then up in Stockton with Dolores and Gil Padilla, and in probably around October or November, I spent
61.
Yeah, I spent a couple months up there. And then I would regularly go to CSO meetings, board meetings and conventions. And just to, you know, watch, observe, learn. And sometimes dropped in on local CSO meetings if, you know, I knew about them. Or, and then I was at the convention where CSER resigned. Would have been probably March of 62, something like that. And when was it? Must have been early 62. Because he got here at the end of March, and he got to Delano, I mean, at the end of March of 62. And I remember very well watching. I mean, the two things were being voted on that were key. One was to increase the dues so that there would be enough income to support organizing among farm workers based on CSER's work in Oxnard, right? And two, to establish farm worker organizing as a program of the CSO. And it was sort of like an urban-rural, middle-class, poor people struggle. I mean, that wasn't quite that simple, right? But the strong spokesmen for keeping the dues the same and not organizing farm workers were like urban CSO people, more upwardly mobile.
Mm-hmm.
And the strong voices for paying more dues and organizing farm workers were the poor, rural people. And I remember the arguments from J.J. Rodriguez and others that the unions should organize organize workers and we should not, that we're a civic action organization, and blah, 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 blah. So they voted them both down. And I remember sitting there thinking to myself and saying to some other people, observers, too, why don't Fred and CSER do something? I mean, you know, CSER could turn this around. He could, you know, if he used his influence, if he told them how seriously he was about this, he, you know, if they thought they were going to lose him.
I had to go see Ronnie tomorrow.
I know.
I was coming to close the door.
Oh, very good.
But you don't close.
Well, that's not my fault. You never fixed it.
But...
I must have known enough to know that how badly Caesar wanted it, those votes, right? Can't remember whether I talked to him about it, or Dolores, or how I knew that, right? And, of course, the truth was, all he wanted was a clean break with CSO. He didn't want CSO on his back when he went organizing farm workers. So that both actions were fine with him. Mm. He just didn't want an emotional, nasty, angry, he wanted an issue-oriented break. You know, like, okay, I understand why you did it. I have to do this.
So that's why he didn't try to convince people that weren't in favor of it.
Right.
If there had been a lot of support, if that had been the major feeling, he would have, of course, been pleased.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I mean, he was ambivalent about it. He wasn't sure he wanted an old organization around going into this new arena. So he was ambivalent about that. He probably knew how it was going to go. I mean, he certainly knew that he and Fred knew the politics of the organization and who had influence and, you know, and how many votes there were going to be and what chapters were going to, you know, be the most influential, etc. So he probably knew that if he stayed out of it, it would go the way it went, which was fine with him. It seemed terrible to me, but much later, I realized that was... And, of course, it was such an education, right? Poor people wanted the dues to be increased. And the rich people wanted the dues to stay $3 a month, or whatever it was.
Jim Drake was recalling that you called him up and said Cesar Chavez is moving to Delano, and these are some of the arrangements he's making, and I'd like you to follow him around for a while and see if this is something we'd like to get involved in. Is that how you remember that?
I don't remember it that way. It's true. The result is true, but I remember it as sort of like Jim was coming on staff, and this was his opportunity to get some training with Caesar. Mm-hmm. As he was beginning... See, Jim came right about that time, mm-hmm. right as Caesar started. So like Sue and Mary and all the others that had training with CSO, so now Jim's chance was to have training with Caesar. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I remember it. I mean, there might have been more to it than that, I don't know. Then I also remember that when I would be coming through Delano, I'd stop and see the family, and if Caesar was there, talk to him. And of course, from Jim, we would get reports as to how they were doing and, you know, how it was going day to day. And then Caesar came to a couple of our staff retreats. Helen came to a couple too. Just kind of like we invited him. We wanted to know how he was doing and what was going on, and we were interested. And so we like invited him to make a report. And, I mean, to him it was, like, also support. I mean, he felt the support. Mm-hmm. And he was having, you know, he had his ups and downs, for sure. Mm-hmm. And there were ways, you know, we could help him out in little ways, you know, with gas or credit card or a mimeograph machine. I think we got him a mimeograph machine. And I guess Caesar expected us to support him when, you know, when the chips were down.
In 64, 65.
In 65, yeah, when the shit really hit the fan. I'm sure he did.
Well, I would expect that he would.
Yeah. I mean, he was planning. He was organizing. He knew that he would need a base of support that was broader than just farm workers in Delano. So, you know,
because he knew the history of farm labor organizing, for one thing.
But he did it. I mean, if he was self-consciously organizing us as a future base, right? I mean, he did it in a very human way. I mean, it was totally unnoticeable as a strategy. It was just sort of like, you know, our being together whenever we could be and finding out what was going on and helping him any way we could. And
that's a great Mexican cultural...
Yeah, and
ability, I think.
Yeah, and I'm curious someday. Maybe I've asked him. I don't remember. But anyway, so I'm curious how much of it was just sort of like people who met along the way, and how much of it was conscious. I mean, how much of it was he knew us, met us and knew us and expected us to support him. And how much of it was like organizing us so that when the chips were down, we would support him.
I think anyone can be really smart and know as much as he does about organizing and not have some level of awareness
that he was going to need this resource someday. Have to. Plus, it's all impossible to separate the two things.
Yeah.
I mean, when was he being organizer supreme and when was he being Cesar Chavez? The guy who needs friends or whatever.
And after you left this morning, we were talking about a quote that he has in the Levy book about 100% loyalty, when he was referring to Gandhi. You'd left by then, hadn't you, when I brought that up?
Yes, yes.
And I was pushing him to talk about his own demands for loyalty. But I was pretty interested in how he moved that. And I appreciate what he had to say about it, too, because the authenticity of it, I mean, it doesn't mean that there isn't something else, another level, but he was talking about, you know, needing 100% loyalty to making change for farm workers. And it's absolutely, totally believable with him. And I appreciated his response on that.
Well, yeah. In terms of the basic thing, that's in terms of the union and its goals, that 100% loyalty is required. It's very easy and possible to disagree about things along the way, right? But sort of like when the decision's made and we're on a course, and then you're either part of the team or you're not part of the team, and it's pretty obvious who is and who isn't. So I mean, it's not hard to examine or sort out in this environment or in a field office or anywhere else. You just know, you know. Some people think this is, you know, crazy and aren't really with it. And other people say, well, this may not be the best way, but this is the way we're going to do it.
As it diverting from what we were talking about, do you think that 100% loyalty issue has gotten in some ways sort of sadly into some really bad waters where people have left because they understood that there was a program decided and they weren't ready to buy into it and were leaving and decided to leave, but then we're seen as not being 100% loyal, seen as having other priorities, but that wasn't okay.
It just depended on how they did it. Because people, somewhere along the line, someone makes internally the decision, look, I just can't do this anymore. Or maybe I can, but Pudge and I can't.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Or my kids are getting older and we're gonna have to have some money.
Mm-hmm.
Or the boycott may be the thing to do, but I ain't going out on any more boycotts.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they decide that somewhere inside themselves, and at a certain point they say to Cesar, you know, I'm gonna go and do this other thing. I don't feel bad about the union, I don't feel bad about you or my time I've spent here, I've just got to go do this other thing. And Leroy did it that way. Jerry basically did it that way.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have. Then other people, for whatever reason, right, they can't make the break. It can't be my decision. It's too much a part of my life. It's too dear. It's too important.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be me doing this. It's something he did or the union did or Frank did or Barbara did or, you know.
I don't want to leave.
Somebody pushed me into this corner and they're making me go. And so then it comes out in all those, you know, angry, frustrated forms. Mm-hmm. And basically, I think the same things happened. They just, this person also decided, I can't do this anymore. And but they just, you know, they psychologically, they deal with it in an entirely different way. And I'm, you know, there's plenty of cause for going the bad way. I mean, there's always some frustration or some decision or some unfairness, internal unfairness, right, that you can use to say that's what's driving me out. Mm-hmm. But then there are others people who just get flat out fired. Mm-hmm. You know, because for reasons that are unclear unless you're right there, it's like a divorce. I mean, unless you're right there, you just don't really know what happened.
The cry is always, you never can ferret out.
No, I mean, you always have sympathy with the victim and wonder, you know, like, what happened? It's clear where the power is, mm-hmm. right? And you try, if it's important to you, you try and understand, but mm-hmm. it's real hard to know. Mm-hmm. That's one of the first things I learned. And one of the first things I told Fred was, Fred, really know what's going on, because you don't know from what they've said what's going on.
Yeah,
as a supervisor,
like,
I know. I mean, I just, there's just some wonderful, wonderful, delightful, warm, sweet people who just don't perform. Who just, you know, I can't work with them. I don't want to work with them. They're not doing the job. They don't show up on time, whatever. Mm-hmm. And from the outside, it would seem like, you know, I was a bully. Or a bad boss, but from the employer-employee relationship, you know, it's different. Mm-hmm. I might be wrong, but it's a lot more complicated than good guys and bad guys. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you never know.
I also wanted to ask you about two other events besides when you were first getting to know Caesar. One of the things I want to do in the book is to because I have not seen it written up, I'd like to have you recall about your Safeway fast, starting with some of the dates and stuff.
Well, what was it, June? I think it was like June of 69.
Uh-huh. I know we were in Colton.
Yeah. It was June of 69. It was the year before. And in fact, right toward the end of the fast, I think there was these first rumors about a possible settlement, you know, with the Coachella grape growers. It was like a false start on negotiations. But it was Joe and I basically working closely together, Joe Cerda, mm-hmm. and talking together and just reaching the point, you know, like, what do we have to do? I mean, it was probably the result of organizational weakness, right? Mm-hmm. And we just didn't have that much pressure on Safeway. And we were trying to get Safeway to remove grapes, and we didn't have that many people, and Joe was a really beautiful human being, but he was not Leroy Chatfield, or...
Was he in charge of the LA boycott?
He was in charge of the LA boycott for a couple of years. And like, so I guess out of the experience of Caesar's fast and other cities' fasts, and you know, we decided we would fast as a tribe, dramatizing and trying to get some visibility and some support for the Safeway campaign. And but we had a hard time maintaining unity. The joke kept making dramatic statements about, you know, to the death, you know, like, and I said, Joe, that is not, that's not our plan, don't say that. That's not my plan. But he was getting very emotional and very dramatic about it. And so we, you know, what we picked, we couldn't have been, I mean, we were focused on the East LA and the central city of LA. It couldn't have been worse strategy. We picked the one on Western, just above the Harbor Freeway, the Santa Monica Freeway. I mean, almost, I mean, real nice people, but almost all poor people, you know, nasty looking parking lot, no visibility. I mean, the press would only come there if, you know, if they were given direct orders from their station manager. People, hot summer, kids going by licking ice cream cones all the time because it was like a Thrifty or, you know, one of those ice cream places, right? I often said to Joe, "Joe, we can just die. No one cares. We can just die here. No one cares. Look at all those ice cream cones." And then Jim and you probably and other people organized a real neat service on a Friday night after the first week or the second week of the fast. We did get some publicity on that. Mm-hmm. And but then Joe got to be sick. And he began to get cramps and. Then he got scared, and his wife got scared. And then they wanted, to end it, you know. So I don't know what, I think we probably used the occasion of the false negotiations mm-hmm. to sort of like bring it to a conclusion.
How many days was it?
20 or something, you know, 2.5 or 3 weeks, maybe 21 days.
You do not remember how many days it was?
No, but I do have a file on it. What's there. It's right in the office, I think.
Okay.
So that'd be easy to find out.
All right.
It's not a very thick file. It was, well, no, nothing done in love is lost in the universe, right?
Right.
But that was close.
Well, out in Colton, I didn't know any of the rest of this, but I was just so concerned, and I was just, I mean, it had a really good effect on me. I mean, you didn't know that. I should have been letting you know.
Right.
But, and I'm sure that was true of other people as well.
I kind of knew. You know, both of us kind of knew that it was intensifying people's, you know, sense of urgency about the boycott. But right toward the end, then all that began to get kind of, like diffused by these articles about maybe the grape growers are getting together with the farm workers and, you know, just sort of like a couple of articles in Times sort of dissipated that real fast. So the timing was, it was a good learning experience, shall we say.
The other event I wanted to ask you to recall is one that I have heard you talk about before, and I read the account recently in Levy's book, but I wanted to hear your recollection. That was when you and Caesar and Saladini were put in jail. And I remember the circumstances surrounding it, and you were first taken into custody out there at that ranch and kept in a truck for several hours and so on.
Yeah. Well, some workers had come out on strike against the Giorgio, right down there. That was probably the ranch where Cecil went as an observer.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Mm-hmm. The election observer, mm-hmm. and. And the workers wanted to go in for their checks that they were still owed, but they were either genuinely afraid, or Caesar told us they were genuinely afraid. So they wanted to be, you know, someone to go along with them. So Caesar said he was going to go, and he wanted to know if we wanted to go, and Saladini definitely wanted to go. He smelled drama. And I probably had mixed feelings about it, but we just walked in with the workers. Did we walk in or did we drive in?
I thought you drove in.
Yeah, we probably drove in, and then we were stopped at a certain point by the guards and dogs and all those other stuff. And I don't suppose we ever got all the way into where the payroll place was for the workers.
It sounded like it.
And they arrested us and took us to some substation, sheriff's substation. Mm-hmm. And remember. Anyway, there's a sheriff's substation near Borrego Springs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's... It must have been late in the day. Because it was like... It was getting toward evening. And they strip searched us, which was very humiliating for the workers.
At that substation.
At that substation. And then they chained us in trees, I think in threes, either in pairs or in threes. But we put our clothes back on, and then they chained us. Some of the accounts sound as if they stripped us, chained us naked, and took us to San Diego that way. And so they chained us together in the sheriff's car and took us to San Diego to be booked. And then I guess the next day we were out. And then sometime later there was a trial.
What was the outcome?
We were found guilty.
Of trespassing.
Yeah, it was really, you know, pretty far out. The prosecutor, you know, prosecutor concerned, this was the first wave of the Chinese invasion. It was a classic Red Scare trial.
Hmm.
I testified, I guess Caesar did, Alan Dean did.
Was there a lot of publicity in San Diego about
some,
it?
Some, and some supporters came up from San Diego to observe the trial.
Came up? Where was it held? Was there a change of venue to Los Angeles? Or?
No, but it was somewhere in that rural area. It wasn't in San Diego, it was somewhere nearer to Borrego Springs.
Yeah. What I was wondering was the what was the audience the prosecutor was playing to?
The jury. Because I think most of the people in the courtroom, other than the jury, were either very closely associated with DiGiorgio or the majority were like sympathizers of ours who had just come to watch the proceedings. It must have been an education for them in their own county to hear the stuff that was coming out of that guy's mouth. I mean, he just played it up as a, we're going to stop communism right here. If we don't stop it here, God knows what will happen to us.
That was their mistake.
They should have stopped it right there, right then.
What are we taking?
I think it's the food the kids have.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But once they had that power, then they had the right to set certain minimums.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember that we had worked really hard for that. That's what I was recalling.
Yeah.
And that we worked really hard to get that decision.
Probably the issue for us was whether they would extend their jurisdiction to farm labor. In other words, they had been established to protect women and minors who work.
Uh-huh.
And did their mandate include agriculture?
Oh, Jorge's name? Gosh, I have it written down in my office, but I'm here.
Cecil remembers a lot about that. I'll
Connie and Jorge?
I know her name is Maureen. M-O-R-I-N. Are you in your office?
Sometime.
No,
and I don't think this is the time. I'd like to talk to you some about your concept of servant ministry.
Let me try and call around.
Because it's like I was so young when my ideas were being formed, when I was in formation, that it was like I never thought about it a lot. I mean, I just sort of developed an idea that was not thought through.
Let me say something about it now, because it's not, to me, it's not complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not too theological. For some reason, right? My training, my upbringing, my psychological makeup, what I had learned in East Harlem. For some reason, I just knew, you know, at a very, very basic level, that what Caesar and the farm workers were doing was the primary thing that was happening.
I saw Jorge outside. outside your house today, right?
That, you know, in terms
what's
of
his last name?
In terms of serving the needs of farm workers, that was the thing. That was what was happening. Mm-hmm. And that what we were doing was like secondary, supplemental, helpful, supportive. Mm-hmm. And which meant that we would always take our lead from them. And that we would try and orient our support to what they really needed. You know, not what somebody far away thought they needed, but what they really needed. And of course, that was the critical thing about having Jim and others right there. Mm-hmm. I mean,
so
we usually knew what the union really needed. And when Caesar called, I knew what the union really needed, because he would never call unless it was something they really needed. And so it was two things, right? It was just knowing that was primary, and secondly, having someone always there that could, you know, feed us back. Mm-hmm. Either Caesar directly or Jim or somebody else, or like supplementing, filling in, giving the perspective. Mm-hmm. What it made me think of was the Freedom Ride. I don't know why. But I was thinking about, where is that, you know, for me, personally, where does that come from? I just remember when we got to Tallahassee, and they closed the restaurant at the airport, and the rednecks were beginning to surround the airport, and the press all wanted to talk to the Freedom Riders, right? And I knew better than anybody in that place, including Bob Brown or any of the older people, that we were supplemental to what those local folks were trying to do. But they were doing it. Mm-hmm. And they were taking the risks. And they were sacrificing, right? And we were just sort of like along to help. And about half of our group went back early because they had appointments or other things. And I was just, it was a scandal. I mean, how could you leave these people go through this every day. How could you leave them? You know, until this thing was finished one way or another. So we either got in that restaurant or were arrested. And so it came from something, you know, in my nature. Mm-hmm. Something, you know, about the way I was raised or not raised or loved or not loved or something, you know, that just I had that gut feeling for not just the underdog, but like really, who was really doing it. And I never think as a group any of us ever really overestimated our role. Mm-hmm. One of the problems I'm having with Sid's writing is that he has a tendency to like overestimate what the church did. Mm-hmm. And it was supplemental, clearly, absolutely, always supplemental. So that was part of the strength of our relationship. You know, not just the Micah Ministries and the unions, but mine and Caesar's. I mean, it was never anything he had to explain. You know, he didn't have to waste his breath telling us what was the most important thing. Because, mm-hmm. That's the way we operated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the total arena, the most important thing to do
was what they farm
were
workers wanted to do. I mean, sometimes we didn't always agree. Most of the time we agreed. We were lucky, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that would have been a much harder relationship with some, you know, semi-organized, semi-violent, semi-political, semi-religious, you know, if it had been a much more mixed up group, it might have been not sustainable. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm glad you like it.
It's 1:30. I think we ought to stop.
But anyway, to me, that's like that's the gut of it.
And, I really liked reading the things that you said.
In time, he'll change his mind.
based on that confrontation. You could always, someone like me, I can always slow him down. If he's going to do something that I think is a mistake, I can always slow him down to a near stop.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, if my position is strong, I'll be able to agree.
Mm.
Not in the argument.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, he doesn't like losing.
Yes.
Baseball, chess, or whatever.
Who of us does?
Arguments.
I hate losing. I try my best to not ever lose in an argument.
Oh, no, you can cheat and drain, but don't lose. Where did you go?
Should I tell him about the note he sent you, Hank?
I want to hear.
Okay, so they, after this argument, Pudge was trying to figure out, like, okay, now how do I work with this son of a bitch? So she sent him a note, sort of like saying, you know, our last meeting was a disaster. I don't know if we can work together or not, but at least we ought to talk about it or do something. So he sent her a note. He says, I didn't think the last meeting was a disaster at all. That, because he made his point or something. I don't know what. But it didn't bother him that she walked out on him and slammed his files around. And then he said, somewhere in the middle of there, he says, I don't at all think you're stupid or not prepared or whatever it was. She'd accused him of thinking. He says, in fact, he says, I think we can work together because I think we're a lot alike.
Interesting.
That was him on the phone.
Trying to find out.
Jorge's last name.
Mm-hmm.